in all but name. But these worries came only late at night. In the daytime, he was only grateful for Flagg's support. If not for Sasha, Roland might have been a much worse king than he really was, and that was because the little voice he sometimes heard in the night when he couldn't sleep held much more of the truth than his daytime gratitudes. Flagg really was running the kingdom, and Flagg was a very bad man. We will have to speak more of him later, unfortunately, but we'll let him go for now, and good riddance. Sasha had broken Flagg's power over Roland a little. Her own advice was good and practical, and it was much more kind and just than the magician's. She never really liked Flagg. Few and Delane did, and many shuddered at his very name. But her dislike was mild. Her feelings might have been much different if she had known how carefully Flagg watched her, and with what growing poisonous hate. 9. Once Flagg really did set out to poison Sasha. This was after she asked Roland to pardon a pair of army deserters whom Flagg had wanted beheaded in the Plaza of the Needle. Deserters, he had argued, were a bad example. If one or two were allowed to get away without paying the full penalty, others might try it. The only way to discourage them, he said, was to show them the heads of those who had already tried it. Other would-be deserters would look at those fly-blown heads with their staring eyes and think twice about the seriousness of their service to the king. Sasha, however, had discovered facts about the case from one of her maids that Roland didn't know. The mother of the older boy had fallen gravely ill. There were 3 younger brothers and 2 younger sisters in the family. All might have died in the bitter cold of the Delane winter if the boy hadn't left his encampment, gone home, and chopped wood for his mother. The younger boy had gone because he was the older's best friend and his sworn blood brother. Without the younger boy, it might have taken 2 weeks to chop enough wood to keep the family through the winter. With both of them working at top speed, it had taken only 6 days. This was putting it in a different light. Roland had loved his own mother very much, and would gladly have died for her. He made inquiries and found out that Sasha had the right of the story. He also found out that the deserters had left only after a sadistic sergeant major had repeatedly refused to relay their requests for compassionate leave to their superior, and that as soon as 4 cords of wood had been chopped, they had gone back, although both had known they must be court-martialed and face the headsman's axe. Roland pardoned them. Flagg nodded, smiled, and said only, "Your will is Delane's will, sire." Not for all the gold in the 4 kingdoms would he have allowed Roland to see the sick fury that rose in his heart when his will was balked. Roland's pardon of the boys was greatly praised in Delane, because many of Roland's subjects also knew the true facts, and those who didn't know them were quickly informed by the rest. Roland's wise and compassionate pardon of the 2 was remembered when other less humane decrees, which were as a rule also the magician's ideas, were imposed. All of this made no difference to Flagg. He had wanted him killed, and Sasha had interfered. Why could Roland not have married another? He had known none of them, and cared for women not at all. Why not another? Well, it didn't matter. Flagg smiled at the pardon, but he swore in his heart then that he would attend Sasha's funeral. On the night Roland signed the pardon, Flagg went to his gloomy basement laboratory. There he donned a heavy glove and took a death-watch spider from a cage where he had kept her for 20 years, feeding her newborn baby mice. Each of the mice he fed the spider was poisoned and dying. Flagg did this to increase the potency of the spider's own poison, which was already potent beyond belief. The spider was blood-red and as big as a rat. Her bloated body quivered with venom. Venom dripped from her stinger and clear drops that burned smoking holes in the top of Flagg's work table. "Now die, my pretty, and kill a queen," Flagg whispered, and crushed the spider to death in his glove, which was made of a magical steel mesh which resisted the poison. Yet still that night when he went to bed, his hand was swelled and throbbing and red. Poison from the spider's crushed, twisted body gushed into the goblet. Flagg poured brandy over the deadly stuff, then stirred the 2 together. When he took the spoon from the glass, its bowl was twisted and misshapen. The queen would take one sip and fall dying on the floor. Her death would be quick, but extremely painful, Flagg thought with satisfaction. Sasha was in the habit of taking a glass of brandy each night because she often had trouble falling asleep. Flagg rang for a servant to come and take the drink to her. Sasha never knew how close she came to death that night. Moments after brewing the deadly drink, before the servant knocked, Flagg poured it down the drain in the center of his floor and stood listening to it hiss and bubble away into the pipe. His face was twisted with hate. When the hissing had died away, he flung the crystal goblet into the far corner with all his force. It shattered like a bomb. The servant knocked and was admitted. Flagg pointed to where the shards glittered. "I've broken a goblet," he said. "Clean it up. Use a broom, idiot. If you touch the pieces, you'll regret it." 10. He poured the poison down the drain at the last moment because he realized he might well be caught. If Roland had loved the young queen just a little less, Flagg would have chanced it. But he was afraid that Roland, in his wounded fury at the loss of his wife, would never rest until he found the killer and saw his head on the spike at the very tip of the needle. It was the one crime he would see avenged, no matter who had committed it. And would he find the murderer? Flagg thought he might. Hunting, after all, was the thing Roland did best. So Sasha escaped, that time, protected by Flagg's fear and her husband's love. And in the meantime, Flagg still had the king's ear in most matters. Concerning the dollhouse, however, in that matter you could say Sasha won, even though Flagg had by then succeeded in ridding himself of her. 11. Not long after Flagg made his disparaging comments about dollhouses and royal sissies, Roland crept into the dead queen's morning room, unseen, and watched his son at play. The king stood just inside the door, his brow deeply furrowed. He was thinking much harder than he was used to thinking, and that meant the boulders were rolling around in his head and his nose was stuffy. He saw that Peter was using the dollhouse to tell himself stories, to make believe, and that the stories he made up were not sissy stories at all. They were stories of blood and thunder, and armies and dragons. They were, in other words, stories after the king's own heart. He discovered in himself a wistful desire to join his son, to help him make up even better tales in which the dollhouse and all its fascinating contents and its make-believe family figured. Most of all, he saw that Peter was using Sasha's dollhouse to keep Sasha alive in his heart, and Roland approved of this most of all, because he missed his wife sorely. Sometimes he was so lonely he almost cried. Kings, of course, do not cry. And if, on one or two occasions after Sasha had died, he awoke with the case on his pillow damp, what of that? The king left the room as silently as he had come. Peter never saw him. Roland lay awake most of that night, thinking deeply about what he had seen. And although it was hard for him to endure Flagg's disapproval, he saw him the next morning in a private audience before his resolve could weaken, and told him he had thought the matter over carefully and decided Peter should be allowed to play with the dollhouse as long as he wished. He said he believed it was doing the boy no harm. With that out, he settled back uneasily to wait for Flagg's rebuttal, but no rebuttal came. Flagg only raised his eyebrows. This Roland barely saw in the deep shadow of the hood Flagg always wore, and said, "Your will, sire, is the will of the kingdom." Roland knew from the tone that Flagg thought his decision was a bad one, but the tone also told him Flagg would not dispute it further. He was deeply relieved to be let off so cheaply. Later that day, when Flagg suggested that the farmers of the eastern barony could stand higher taxes in spite of the drought that had killed most of their crops the year before, Roland agreed eagerly. In truth, having the old fool, for so Flagg thought Roland to be in his deeper thoughts, go against his wishes in the matter of the dollhouse seemed a very minor thing to the magician. The rise in taxes for the Eastern Barony was the important thing, and Flagg had a deeper secret, one which pleased him well. In the end, he had succeeded in murdering Sasha after all. 12. In those days, when a queen or any woman of royal birth was taken to bed to deliver a child, a midwife was called in. The doctors were all men, and no man was allowed to be with a woman when she was about to have a child. The midwife who delivered Peter was Anna Crookbrows of the 3rd Southards Alley. She was called again when Sasha's time with Thomas came around. Anna was past 50 at the time when Sasha's second labor began, and a widow. She had one son of her own, and in his 20th year he contracted the shaking disease, which always killed its victims in terrible pain after some years of suffering. She loved this boy very much, and at last, after every other idea had proved useless, she went to Flagg. This had been 10 years before. Neither prince yet born, and Roland himself still a royal bachelor. He received her in his dank basement rooms, which were near the dungeons. During their interview, the uneasy woman could sometimes hear the lost screams of those who had been locked away from the sun's light for years and years. And, she thought with a shudder, if the dungeons were near, then the torture chambers must also be near. Nor did Flagg's apartment itself make her feel any easier. Strange designs were drawn on the floor in many colors of chalk. When she blinked, the design seemed to change. In a cage hung from a long black manacle, a two-headed parrot cawed and sometimes talked to itself, one head speaking, the other head answering. Musty books frowned down at her. Spiders spun in dark corners. From the laboratory came a mixture of strange chemical smells. Yet she stammered out her story somehow, and then waited in an agony of suspense. "I can cure your son," he said finally. Anna Crookbrows's ugly face was transformed into something near beauty by her joy. "My lord," she gasped, and could think of no more, so she said it again. "Oh, my lord." But in the shadow of his hood, Flagg's white face remained distant and brooding, and she felt afraid again. "What would you pay for such a miracle?" he asked.
"Anything,"
she gasped, and meant it.
"Oh, my lord Flagg, anything."
"I ask for one favor," he said. "Will you give it?"
"Gladly."
"I don't know what it is yet, but when the time comes, I shall." She had fallen on her knees before him, and now he bent toward her. His hood fell back, and his face was terrible indeed. It was the white face of a corpse with black holes for eyes. "And if you refuse what I ask, woman?"
"I shall not refuse. Oh, my lord, I shall not. I shall not. I swear it on my dear husband's name."
"Then it is well. Bring your son to me tomorrow night after dark." She led the poor boy in the next night. He trembled and shook. His head nodded foolishly. His eyes rolled. There was a slick of drool on his chin. Flagg gave her a dark, plum-colored potion in a beaker. "Have him drink this," he said. "It will blister his mouth, but have him drink every drop. Then get the fool out of my sight." She murmured to him. The boy's shaking increased for a moment as he tried to nod his head. He drank all of the liquid and then doubled over, screaming. "Get him out," Flagg said.
"Yes, get him out,"
one of the parrot's two heads cried.
"Get him out! No screaming allowed here,"
the other head screamed. She got him home, sure that Flagg had murdered him. But the next day, the shaking disease had left her son completely, and he was well. Years passed. When Sasha's labor with Thomas began, Flagg called for her and whispered in her ear. They were alone in his deep rooms, but even so, it was better that such a dread command be whispered. Anna Crookbrows's face went deadly white, but she remembered Flagg's words. "If you refuse..." And would not the king have two children? She had only one. And if the king wanted to remarry and have even more, let him. In Delane, women were plentiful. So she went to Sasha and spoke encouragingly, and at a critical moment, a little knife glittered in her hand. No one saw the one small cut she made. A moment later, Anna cried,
"Push, my queen! Push, for the baby comes!"
Sasha pushed. Thomas came from her as effortlessly as a boy zipping down a slide. But Sasha's lifeblood gushed out upon the sheet. 10 minutes after Thomas came into the world, his mother was dead. And so Flagg was not concerned about the piffling matter of the dollhouse. What mattered was that Roland was growing old, and there was no meddling queen to stand in his way. And now he had not one son to choose from, but two. Peter was, of course, the elder, but that did not really matter. Peter could be gotten out of the way if time should prove him unsuitable for Flagg's purposes. He was only a child and could not defend himself. I have told you that Roland never thought longer or harder on any matter during his entire reign than he did on this one question. Whether or not Peter should be allowed access to Sasha's dollhouse, cunningly crafted by the great Ellender. I have told you that the result of his thought was a decision that ran against Flagg's wishes. I have also told you that Flagg considered this of little importance. Was it? That you must decide for yourself, after you have heard me to the end. 13. Now let many long years pass, all in a twinkling. One of the great things about tales is how fast time may pass when not much of note is happening. Real life is never that way, and it is probably a good thing. Time only passes faster in histories. And what is a history except a grand sort of tale where passing centuries are substituted for passing years? During those years, Flagg watched both boys carefully. He watched them over the aging king's shoulder as they grew up, calculating which should be king when Roland was no more. It did not take him long to decide it should be Thomas, the younger. By the time Peter was 7, he knew he did not like the boy. When Peter was 9, Flagg made a strange and unpleasant discovery. He feared Peter as well. The boy had grown up strong and straight and handsome. His hair was dark, his eyes a dark blue that is common to people of the Western Barony. Sometimes, when Peter looked up quickly, his head cocked a certain way, he resembled his father. Otherwise, he was Sasha's son almost entirely in his looks and ways. Unlike his short father, with his bow-legged walk and his clumsy way of moving, Roland was graceful only when he was horsed, Peter was tall and lithe. He enjoyed the hunt and hunted well, but it was not his life. He also enjoyed his lessons. Geography and history were his particular favorites. His father was puzzled and often impatient with jokes. The point of most had to be explained to him, and that took away all the fun. What Roland liked was when the jesters pretended to slip on banana peels, or knocked their heads together, or when they staged pie fights in the great hall. Such things were about as far as Roland's idea of good fun extended. Peter's wit was much quicker and more subtle, as Sasha's had been, and his rollicking, boyish laughter often filled the palace, making the servants smile at each other approvingly. While many boys in Peter's position would have become too conscious of their own grand place in the scheme of things to play with anyone not of their own class, Peter became best friends with a boy named Ben Stodd when both children were 8. Ben's family was not royalty, and though Andrew Stodd, Ben's father, had some faint claim to the high blood of the kingdom on his mother's side, they could not even rightly be called nobility. Squire was probably the kindest term one could have applied to Andy Stodd, and Squire's son to his boy. Even so, the once prosperous Stodd family had fallen upon hard times, and while there could have been queerer choices for a prince's best friend, there couldn't have been many. They met at the annual farmer's lawn party when Peter was 8. The lawn party was a yearly ritual most kings and queens viewed as tiresome at best. They were apt to put in a token appearance, drink the quick traditional toast, and then be away after bidding the farmers enjoy themselves and thanking them for another fruitful year. This was also part of the ritual, even if the crops had been poor. If Roland had been that sort of king, Peter and Ben would never have gotten the chance to know each other. But, as you might have guessed, Roland loved the farmer's lawn party, looked forward to it each year, and usually stayed until the very end, and more than once was carried away drunk and snoring loudly. As it happened, Peter and Ben were paired in the three-legged sack race, and they won it, although it ended up being much closer than at first it seemed it would be. Leading by almost 6 lengths, they took a bad spill, and Peter's arm was cut. "I'm sorry, my prince," Ben cried. His face had gone pale, and he may have been visualizing the dungeons, and I know his mother and father, watching anxiously from the sidelines, were. If it weren't for bad luck, Andy Stodd was fond of growling, the Stodds would have no luck at all. More likely, he was just sorry for the hurt he fancied he had caused, or was amazed to see that the blood of the future king was as red as his own. "Don't be a fool," Peter said impatiently. "It was my fault, not yours. I was clumsy. Hurry and get up. They're catching us." The two boys, made into a single clumsy three-legged beast by the sack into which Peter's right leg and Ben's left one had been tightly tied, managed to get up and lurch on. Both had been badly winded by the fall, however, and their long lead had been cut to almost nothing. Approaching the finish line, where crowds of farmers, not to mention Roland, standing among them without the slightest feeling of awkwardness or of being somewhere he shouldn't, were cheering deliriously, two huge, sweating farm boys began to close in. That they would overtake Peter and Ben in the last 10 yards of the race seemed almost inevitable. "Faster, Peter!" Roland bellowed, swinging a huge mug of mead with such enthusiasm that he poured most of it onto his own head. In his excitement, he never noticed. "Jackrabbit, son, be a jackrabbit. Those clodbusters are almost up your butt and over your back." Ben's mother began to moan, cursing the fate that had caused her son to be paired up with the prince. "If they lose, he'll have our Ben thrown into the deepest dungeon in the castle," she moaned. "Hush, woman," Andy said. "He'd not. He's a good king." He believed it, but he was still afraid. Stodd luck was, after all, Stodd luck. Ben, meanwhile, had begun to giggle. He couldn't believe he was doing it, but he was. "Be a jackrabbit," did he say? Peter also began to giggle. His legs ached terribly. Blood was trickling down his right arm, and sweat was flooding his face, which was starting to turn an interesting plum color, but he was also unable to stop. "Yes, that's what he said." "Then let's hop." They didn't look much like jackrabbits as they crossed the finish line. They looked like a pair of strange, crippled crows. It was really a miracle they didn't fall, but somehow they didn't. They managed 3 ungainly leaps. The third one took them across the finish line, where they collapsed, howling with laughter. "Jackrabbit," Ben yelled, pointing at Peter. "Jackrabbit yourself," Peter yelled, pointing back. They swung their arms about each other, still laughing, and were carried on the shoulders of many strong farmers. Andrew Stodd was one of them, and bearing the combined weight of his son and the prince was something he never forgot. To where Roland slipped blue ribbons over their necks. Then he kissed each of them roughly on the cheek, and poured the remaining contents of his mug over their heads, to the wild cheers and huzzas of the farmers. Never, even in the memory of the oldest gaffer there that day, had such an extraordinary race been run. The two boys spent the rest of the day together, and it soon appeared would be content to spend the rest of their lives together, because even a boy of 8 has certain duties, and if he is to be the king someday, he has even more. The two of them could not be together all they wanted to be, but when they could be, they were. Some sniffed at the friendship and said it wasn't right for the king in waiting to be friends with a boy who was little better than a common barony clodbuster. Most, however, looked upon it with approval. It was said more than once over deep cups in the mead houses of Delane that Peter had gotten the best of both worlds, his mother's brains and his father's love of the common folk. There was apparently no meanness in Peter, He never went through a period when he pulled the wings off flies or singed dogs' tails to see them run. In fact, he intervened in the matter of a horse which was to be destroyed by Yosef, the king's head groom, and it was when this tale made its way to Flag that the magician began to fear the king's oldest son, and to think perhaps he did not have as long to put the boy out of the way as he had once thought. For in the affair of the horse with the broken leg, Peter had displayed courage and a depth of resolve which Flag did not like at all. 14. Peter was passing through the stable yard when he saw a horse tethered to the hitching rail just outside the main barn. The horse was holding one of its rear legs off the ground. As Peter watched, Yosef spat on his hands and picked up a heavy maul. What he meant to do was obvious. Peter was both frightened and appalled. He rushed over. "Who told you to kill this horse?" he asked. Yosef, a hardy and robust 60, was a palace fixture. He was not apt to brook the interference of a snot-nosed brat easily, prince or no. He fixed Peter with a thunderous, heavy look that was meant to wilt the boy. Peter, then just 9, reddened, but did not wilt. He seemed to see a look in the horse's mild brown eyes which said, "You're my only hope, whoever you are. Do what you can, please." "My father and his father before him and his father before him," Yosef said, seeing now that he was going to have to say something, like it or not. "That's who told me to kill it. A horse with a broken leg is no good to any living thing, least of all to itself." He raised them all a little. "You see this hammer as a murder weapon. But when you're older, you'll see it for what it really is in cases such as these. A mercy. Now stand back, so you don't get splashed." He raised them all in both hands. "Put it down," Peter said. Yosef was thunderstruck. He had never been interfered with in such a way. "Here, here, what are you a-saying?" "You heard me. I said, put that hammer down." As he said these words, Peter's voice deepened. Yosef suddenly realized, really, really realized, that it was the future king standing here in this dusty stable yard, commanding him. If Peter had actually said as much, if he had stood there in the dust, squeaking, "Put that down, put it down, I said. I'm going to be king someday. King, do you hear? So you put that down." Yosef would have laughed contemptuously, spat, and ended the broken-legged horse's life with one hard swing of his deeply muscled arms. But Peter did not have to say any such thing. The command was clear in his voice and eyes. "Your father shall hear of this, my princeling," Yosef said. "And when he hears it from you, it will be for the second time," Peter replied. "I will let you go about your work with no further complaint, Lord High Groom, if I may put a single question to you, which you answer yes." "Ask your question," Yosef said. He was impressed with the boy, almost against his will. When he had told Yosef that he, Peter, would tell his father of the incident first, Yosef believed he meant what he said. The simple truth shone in the lad's eyes. Also, he had never been called Lord High Groom before, and he rather liked it. "Has the horse doctor seen this animal?" Peter asked. Yosef was thunderstruck. "That is your question? That?" "Yes." "Dear creeping gods, no!" he cried. And seeing Peter flinch, he lowered his voice, squatted before the boy, and attempted to explain. "A horse with a broken leg is a goner, Your Highness. Always a goner. Leg never mends right. There's apt to be blood poisoning. Terrible pain for the horse. Terrible pain. In the end, its poor heart is apt to burst. Or it takes a brain fever and goes mad. Now do you understand what I meant when I said this hammer was mercy rather than murder?" Peter thought long and gravely with his head down. Yosef was silent, squatting before him in an almost unconscious posture of deference, allowing him the full courtesy of time. Peter raised his head and asked, "You say everyone says this?"
"Everyone, Your Highness. Why, my father."
"Then we'll see if the horse doctor says it, too."
"No, pah,"
the groom bellowed, and threw the hammer all the way across the courtyard. It sailed into a pig pen and struck head down in the mud. The pigs grunted and squealed and cursed him in their piggy Latin. Joseph, like Flag, was not used to being balked and took no notice of them. He got up and stalked away. Peter watched him, troubled, sure that he must be in the wrong, and knowing he was apt to face a severe whipping for this little piece of work. Then halfway across the yard, the head groom turned, and a reluctant, grim little smile hit across his face like a single sun ray on a gray morning.
"Go get your horse, doctor," he said. "Get him yourself, son. You'll find him in his animal surgery at the far end of 3rd Eastern Alley, I reckon. I'll give you 20 minutes. If you're not back with him by then, I'm putting my maul into yon horse's brains, prince or no prince."
"Yes, Lord Head Groom," Peter yelled. "Thank you." He raced away. When he returned with the young horse doctor, puffing and out of breath, Peter was sure that the horse must be dead. The son told him 3 times 20 minutes had passed, but Joseph, curious, had waited. Horse doctoring and veterinary medicine were then very new things in Delane, and this young man was only the 3rd or 4th who had practiced the trade. So Joseph's look of sour distrust was far from surprising. Nor had the horse doctor been happy to be dragged away from his surgery by the sweating, wide-eyed prince. But he became less irritated now that he had a patient. He knelt before the horse and felt the broken leg gently with his hands, humming through his nose as he did so. The horse shifted once as something he did pained her.
"Be steady, Nag," the horse doctor said calmly. "Be oh so steady."
The horse quieted. Peter watched all this in an agony of suspense. Joseph watched with his maul leaning nearby and his arms folded across his chest. His opinion of the horse doctor had gone up a little. The fellow was young, but his hands moved with gentle knowledge. At last, the horse doctor nodded and stood up, dusting stable yard grime from his hands.
"Well?"
Peter asked anxiously.
"Killer," the horse doctor said briskly to Joseph, ignoring Peter altogether.
Joseph picked up his maul at once, for he had expected no other conclusion to the affair. But he found no satisfaction in being proved correct. The stricken look on the young boy's face went straight to his heart.
"Wait!"
Peter cried, and although his small face was full of distress, that deepness was in his voice again, making him sound much, much older than his years. The horse doctor looked at him, startled.
"You mean she'll die of blood poisoning?"
Peter asked.
"What?"
the horse doctor asked, eyeing Peter with a new care.
"She'll die of blood poisoning if she's allowed to live? Or her heart will burst? Or she will run mad?"
The horse doctor was clearly puzzled.
"What are you talking about? Blood poisoning?
There is no blood poisoning here. The break is healing quite cleanly, in fact." He looked at Joseph with some disdain.
"I have heard such stories as these before. There is no truth in them." "If you think not, you have much to learn, my young friend," Joseph said.
Peter ignored this. It was now his turn to be bewildered. He asked the young horse doctor,
"Why do you tell the head groom to kill a horse which may heal?"
"Your Highness," the horse doctor said briskly, "this horse would need to be poulticed every day and every night for a month or more to keep any infection from settling in. The effort might be made, but to what end? The horse would always limp. A horse that limps can't work. A horse that limps can't run for idlers to bet on. A horse that limps can only eat and eat and never earn its provender. Therefore, it should be killed."
He smiled, satisfied. He had proved his case.
Then, as Joseph started forward with his hammer again, Peter said, "I'll put on the poultices. If a day should come when I can't, then Stodd will. And she'll be good because she'll be my horse.
and I'll ride her, even if she limps so badly she makes me seasick.
Yosef burst out laughing and clapped the boy on his back so hard his teeth rattled.
Your heart is kind as well as brave, my boy, but lads promise quick and regret at leisure. You'd not be true to it, I reckon.
Peter looked at him calmly. I mean what I say. Yosef stopped laughing all at once. He looked at Peter closely and saw that the boy did indeed mean it, or at least thought he did. There was no doubt in his face.
Well, I can't tarry here all day, the horse doctor said, adopting his former brisk and self-important manner. I've given you my diagnosis. My bill will be presented to the Treasury in due course. Perhaps you'll pay it out of your allowance, Highness. In any case, what you decide to do is not my business. Good day.
Peter and the head groom watched him walk out of the stable yard, trailing a long afternoon shadow at his heels.
He's full of dung, Yosef said when the horse doctor was out the gate, beyond earshot, and thus unable to contradict his words. Mark me, Your Highness, and save yourself a lot of grief. There never was a horse what busted a leg and didn't get blood poisoning. It's God's way.
I'll want to talk to my father about this, Peter said.
And so I think you must, Yosef said heavily.
But as Peter trudged away, he smiled. He thought the boy had done right well for himself. His father would be honor-bound to see the boy was whipped for interfering with his elders, but the head groom knew that Roland set a grave store by both of his sons in his old age, Peter perhaps a bit more than Thomas, and he believed that the boy would get his horse. Of course, he would also get a heartbreak when the horse died, but as the horse doctor had quite rightly said, that was not his business. He knew about the training of horses. The training of princes was best left in other hands. Peter was whipped for interfering in the head groom's affairs, and although it was no solace to his stinging bottom, Peter's mind understood that his father had afforded him great honor by administering the whipping himself, instead of handing Peter over to an underling who might have tried to curry favor by making it easy on the boy. Peter could not sleep on his back for 3 days, and was not able to eat sitting down for nearly a week. But the head groom was also right about the horse. Roland allowed Peter to keep her.
It won't take up your time for long, Peter, Roland advised him. If Yosef says it will die, it will die.
Roland's face was a bit pale, and his old hands were trembling. The beating had pained him more than it had pained Peter, who really was his favorite, although Roland foolishly fancied no one knew this but himself.
I don't know, Peter said. I thought that horse doctoring fellow knew what he was talking about.
It turned out that the horse doctoring fellow had. The horse did not take blood poisoning, and it did not die, and in the end its limp was so slight that even Yosef was forced to admit it was hardly noticeable.
At least when she's fresh, he amended.
Peter was more than just faithful about putting on the poultices. He was nearly religious. He changed old for new 3 times a day, and did it a 4th time before he went to bed. Ben Stodd did stand in for Peter from time to time, but those times were few. Peter named the horse Peony, and they were great friends ever after. Flagg had most assuredly been right about one thing on the day he advised Roland against letting Peter play with the dollhouse. Servants were everywhere. They see things, and their tongues wag. Several servants had witnessed the scene in the stable yard, but if every servant who later claimed to have been there really had been, there would have been a mob of them crowded around the edges of the stable yard that hot summer day. That had, of course, not been the case. But the fact that so many of them found the event worth lying about was a sign that Peter was regarded as an interesting figure indeed. They talked about it so much that it became something of a 9 days' wonder in Delane. Yosef also talked. So, for that matter, did the young horse doctor. Everything that they said spoke well for the young prince. Yosef's word, in particular, carried much weight, because he was greatly respected. He began to call Peter the young king, something he had never done before.
I believe God spared the nag because the young king stood up for her so brave-like,
he said. And he worked at them poultices like a slave. Brave he is. He's got the heart of a dragon. He'll make a king someday, all right. Aye. You should have heard his voice when he told me to hold them all. It was a great story, all right, and Joseph drank on it for the next 7 years, until Peter was arrested for a hideous crime, judged guilty, and sentenced to imprisonment in the cell atop the needle for the rest of his life. 15. Perhaps you are wondering what Thomas was like, and some of you may already be casting him in a villain's part, as a willing co-schemer in Flagg's plot to snatch the crown away from its rightful owner. That was not really the case at all, although to some it always seemed so, and of course Thomas did play a part. He did not seem, I admit, to be a really good boy, at least not at first glance. He was surely not a good boy in the way that Peter was a good boy, but no brother would have looked really good beside Peter, and Thomas knew it well by the time he was 4. That was the year after the famous sack race, and the one in which the famous stable yard incident took place. Peter rarely lied and never cheated. Peter was smart and kind, tall and handsome. He looked like their mother, who had been so deeply loved by the king and the people of Delane. How could Thomas compare with goodness like that? A simple question with a simple answer. He couldn't. Unlike Peter, Thomas was the spitting image of his father. This pleased the old man a little, but it didn't give him the pleasure most men feel when they have a son who carries the clear stamp of their features. Looking at Thomas was too much like looking into a sly mirror. He knew that Thomas's fine blonde hair would gray early and then begin to fall out. Thomas would be bald by the time he was 40. He knew that Thomas would never be tall, and if he had his father's appetite for beer and mead, he would be carrying a big belly before him by the time he was 25. Already his toes had begun to turn in, and Roland guessed Thomas would walk with his own bow-legged swagger. Thomas was not exactly a good boy, but you must not think that made him a bad boy. He was sometimes a sad boy, often a confused boy. He took after his father in another way as well. Hard thinking made his nose stuffy and his head feel like boulders were rolling around inside. And often a jealous boy. But he wasn't a bad boy. Of whom was he jealous? Why, of his brother, of course. He was jealous of Peter. It wasn't enough that Peter would be king, oh no. It wasn't enough that their father liked Peter best, or that the servants liked Peter best, or that their teachers liked Peter best, because he was always ready at lessons and didn't need to be coaxed. It wasn't enough that everyone liked Peter best, or that Peter had a best friend. There was one more thing. When anyone looked at Thomas, his father the king most of all, Thomas thought he knew they were thinking, "We loved your mother, and you killed her in your coming. And what did we get out of the pain and death you caused her? A dull little boy with a round face that has hardly any chin. A dull little boy who couldn't make all 15 of the great letters until he was 8. Your brother Peter was able to make them all when he was 6. What did we get? Not much. Why did you come, Thomas? What good are you? Throne insurance? Is that all you are? Throne insurance in case Peter the Precious should fall off his limping nag and crack his head open? Is that all? Well, we don't want you. None of us want you. None of us want you." The part Thomas played in his brother's imprisonment was dishonorable, but even so, he was not a really bad boy. I believe this, and hope that in time you will come to believe it, too.